Good evening, and welcome to the forum. Tonight we bring you the first part of Dennis Monahan and Amy Goodman's appearance in Kansas City on April 9th at All Souls UU Church. This was part of a book tour for Democracy Now, 20 years covering the movements changing America, and a benefit for KKFI. Before Dennis and Amy speak, we'll hear from Kansas City poet Joseph Davis reading his poem, Black Lives Matter. He is introduced by KKFI's own Bill Sundahl.
So then Joseph Davis is going to come up here and read a poem in just a moment. And right after that is Dennis Moynihan's going to say a few words, and then Amy will be here to wow you with her verbal wowedness.
My fellow listeners, my church, my friends, my beloved community, good evening. I greet you as a member of this church, and I give you Black Lives Matter, a poem I wrote when we dedicated our first Black Lives Matter banner that hung right outside the door here that was stolen, and it's hanging over here now, high up, where it is, we think it is safe. But I read this at the dedication, and I'm going to give a copy to Ms. Goodman, whose voice was instrumental in helping me stop drinking some 12 years ago. I would wake up at the City Union Mission, catch a bus, go to the library, and listen to Democracy Now! So 12 years later, she has taught me what resistance means, not only ethically, but also personally. And this poem is entitled, again, Black Lives Matter. Black lives matter, yet the very air we breathe, this wondrous flesh we inhabit, our ever-resilient presence in this vast, recalcitrant land grab called America is casus belli. Black lives matter and have mattered since the Middle Passage. The cruel efficiency of slave patrols, whips, and pistols, along with the salubrious pleasures of coon hunts and lynchings after church. American power, with its oligarchs and hegemons, has always known Black Lives Matter when exercising their allegedly God-given right to terrorize through myriad blunt traumas, poll taxes, redlining, or that catchy buzzword, austerity. So-called liberals will slogan up the rallying cry, speak truth to power, but those in power already know the truth, that Black lives matter, especially when the time comes for manufacturing Untermenschen before exterminating them for being uppity. From Roger Taney to Ronald Reagan, from Rush Limbaugh to Charles Koch and Prescott Bush, these acolytes of the pathology that is white supremacy know all too well Black lives matter in a most profitable, if savage, way. Because if Black lives did not matter, all these mechanisms, all these structures and policies would implode. The fleeting comforts and elegancies accompanying white privilege would explode into a billion shards of shrapnel, leaving no white people at all, just people. From Darren Wilson to Bull Connor, from Woodrow Wilson praising Birth of a Nation to the bloviating flatulence of Fox News, Black Lives Matters as a fetish, much like a tar baby. Why do you keep on wishing to be in the land of cotton when you are already here? From sea to shining sea, this is your country to run amok in. This is your country where you kept severed limbs and testicles as tchotchkes. You kept them as souvenirs, much like your plundering brethren looted the pyramids and other indigenous artifacts that you hoarded into museums as gaudy testaments to your supposed civility. This is your country. You brutalize, then rationalize the atrocity of being in fear for your lives without so much as a scratch on you, while a black young man's corpse burns for 4 hours in the midsummer sun. Elegant courtier of manifest destiny that he was, you really should not have listened to Rudyard Kipling. Do not blackmail us with that sallow, surly notion of reparation. It will not absolve you in this, your beloved country, of Eurocentric memory and Aryan promise, where beneath the twinned alabaster of white supremacy and privilege lurks a death urge so abysmally psychotic and addictive, even Edgar Allan Poe couldn't stay sober long enough to grasp its depth, its breadth, and its menacing metamorphoses. This is your country where black lives matter even more, because this is not an indispensable nation. You are not a chosen people. You are not a royal priesthood. How can a nation that gorged itself on genocide and slavery ever be? Brothers and sisters of the African diaspora and those who stand with us in solidarity, we know black lives matter by our refusal, in our resistance, by our rebellions, and in our revolt. With the imminent threat of police gunning us down one by one, we summon the collective resilience of those who steadfastly and miraculously kept chasing that long arc of justice in the universe to challenge and rise up against 400 years of terror by fiat, of the genocide for the literal and existential hell and profit of it. We will tear down the master's house. It is the only human, it is the only humane thing to do. It doesn't matter what plowshares or swords we use. We will take to the streets. We will riot if we must. We will tear down the master's house, subverting any ideology that presumes the master to have such a dubious title in the first place. We seek justice, not revenge. For it is then, and only then, that the enslaved master will learn. Black lives matter. They always have. They always will. Thank you.
Dennis is on his way up here.
Hi, I want to thank all of you for being patient. There's no one to blame for tardiness tonight but myself. I organized this tour, and Amy was a willing victim to go along with it. She is just such a tireless advocate for journalism, for independent media. And so when I said, I think we can do 3 events in Missouri in one day. She said that, let's do it. So not knowing just what it would entail. But it's been a wonderful day, and what a great place to end today in Kansas City. I've had a long admiration for KKFI and the amazing group of people, staff, and volunteers that have long kept it strong and present here in this remarkable city. I had the occasion a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, to stand in briefly to shepherd the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee after Bill Clinton famously and notoriously abused his power of clemency by granting campaign donors clemency and ignoring this long-suffering political prisoner, Leonard Peltier. When he was in Leavenworth, he's been moved around the country. But I was in Lawrence at the time, listened to Democracy Now! Every morning, and as I've said before, speaking before KKFI audiences, I'd be at the office, and at about 8:01 in the morning, Leonard would call, as he did every day, and we'd talk about what was on Democracy Now! That day. And it's just a reminder that stations like KKFI not only serve those of us, those of you who feel served by it so well, the community, but you know, these radio waves penetrate prison walls. They reach people far beyond just these four walls and those of us who've come out tonight. It's a really powerful medium. It's an important institution. And if you can look behind Mike Murphy's beard, you'll see an amazing bit of art. It's a clenched fist with a lightning bolt, 100,000 watts of community. He's back there modeling. But it is it's such a valuable asset for the community here. And it's really, as you know, people commit themselves, they volunteer, they work for little to keep that station going. And so your being here tonight is helping to shore up that institution by, you know, contributing money for your tickets and coming out and showing your support. If you're able to visit the KKFI table before you leave tonight, I would encourage you to do what I do with my limited means, is to become a monthly donor to your station. It's so easy to do, and it's so easy to forget that you're doing it every month. You know, just kind of make a budget, an amount that you can part with every month. And then that, as a nonprofit organization, it gives the station a foundation on which to plan and budget. Every month, a certain amount from a pool of monthly donors comes in. And so I just want to make sure that you understand there are ways to support the station, and that's one way that I encourage. And think about it before you leave tonight. But primarily, I want to introduce a great journalist, a tremendous friend of mine, someone I've been really fortunate, honored, and humbled to work with for over 15 years. And so without further ado, please welcome Amy Goodman.
Joy.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being so patient. Dennis is insanely humble. He's not just the coordinator of this tour, though that in itself is a complete masterpiece of some sort, but he's also co-author of the book, Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America, along with my brother, journalist David Goodman. And he is really so key in building the independent media movement. He's starting a full-power FM station in Winter Park, Colorado. He started with Democracy Now! In about 2000, 16 years ago. Democracy Now! Began as the only daily election show in public broadcasting in 1996, 20 years ago. And with Dennis's help and the response of people all over the world, it's grown from 9 stations to today 1,400 stations, public television and radio, all over the country and around the world. And he is an expert driver, too, which really mattered today because it was, I don't even know what to make of what just happened between Columbia, Missouri, and here. We really planned to get here early, although we didn't quite have the distances worked out in terms of time. But we were a little late, and then the man ahead of us on I-70 started to weave, and he was behind a big truck. And we were all behind him, and everyone, I mean, this was very serious. He was really weaving across the road, I-70. And we all traveled in a kind of traffic block behind him. There's no question he was going to crash. And I called the police, and, well, I later learned everyone was calling the police, and very shocked that They didn't respond, and when we called back 10 minutes later, he was now hitting the guardrail. He was going back and forth. And I said, there's going to be a terrible accident, because people who didn't realize behind us, who would then try to speed past us, if anyone came up next to him, he would crash into them. There was no question. And I called back about 10 minutes later, and I said, I know that they've said they've gotten other calls. I said, now you're calling a new district. Tell us what the problem is. But meanwhile, I mean, they must have gotten many, many calls. And then as I was talking to the police, he drove off the road, and he crashed into the brush, and we pulled over, and many cars pulled over, and then we had to find him. Believe it or not, this white SUV, we could not find him in the underbrush. We didn't know if he'd fallen down a ravine, but finally we found the vehicle, and he wasn't drunk. He was an older gentleman, and he was completely incoherent. It's just astounding that nobody got hurt. So we got back on the road, and thanks so much to Bill, who was extremely patient. I said, we're going to be there soon. And no sooner had I said that, and we hung up as we're driving along, and then a car, a double semi-tractor truck, its wheel exploded before us. I don't know what it is. And then I see we're in like some kind of tornado alley, and I'm going, oh my God, there's no question what's going to happen next. But anyway, we're here safe and sound celebrating KKFI, and that's what counts. Independent media in a time of war and elections. What a thrill it is to come back to Kansas City. And is this true that KKFI was one of the 9 community stations that we started with 20 years ago? That's amazing that you guys have been here for the entire ride. What an honor it is to be back with you. You know, I originally come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded more than 60 years ago in Berkeley, California, founded by a war resistor in World War II named Lou Hill. And when he got out of the detention camps after the war, he said there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. The first station, KPFA, not run by corporations, is George Gerbner, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, would say, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. So the first station, KPFA, in 49, the second station, KPFK, in Los Angeles in 59. We'll be having a big fundraiser there. Well, tomorrow we go to the Los Angeles Times Book Festival in the afternoon, and then on to Santa Barbara tomorrow night, and then on Monday to San Francisco, City Arts and Lectures, Tuesday, Stanford University in the afternoon, then Santa Clara, Wednesday, Santa Cruz, Thursday, I can't remember where, and then Salt Lake City, and then all through Colorado and New Mexico, and we'll be going to New Orleans, and we'll be going to Texas, and well, you know, we were 20 minutes late today to Columbia, Missouri. That was our fourth stop. This is our fifth stop. And I'm afraid to say we were an hour late. This is only the fifth stop of 100 cities. We're going to be months late by the time we get to our last city. So please don't tell anyone what happened tonight. We'll try to make up some time tonight. Maybe we can turn the clock back, convince people it's daylight savings time or something. It has a mind of its own, these computers. Just one sec. So Democracy Now! Started 20 years ago. Pacifica Radio started more than 60 years ago. KPFK on the air in 59. My station in New York, WBAI, in 1960. And in that first year of operation, WBAI in New York, it was hosting a debate between Malcolm X and James Baldwin on the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience about the lunch counter sit-ins in the South. WPFW, the Washington station, went on the air in 1977, and there are just five Pacifica stations, and then there are all the affiliates. KPFT went on the air in 1970. That's the station that's in Houston, Texas, in the Petro Metro. And it's the only radio station that has been blown up twice, actually. It was blown up the first time when it first went on the air in 1970. The Ku Klux Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter. And just in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant, they blew it to smithereens. And I thought that was a good song, actually. But then they got back on their feet, they rebuilt the transmitter, and a few months later, they blew it up again with 15 times the dynamite. It's becoming a national story now, it's 1970. A couple months later, I mean, the silver lining was, of course, it's not like Pacific had money for advertising, this certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of the people of Houston. So they get back on their feet. PBS is there to be there for the big return of KPFT. Arlo Guthrie comes into Houston, and as the airwaves are lit up and it's back on the air, Arlo finishes Alice's Restaurant on KPFT, and they've been on the air since. I can't remember if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles, but he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it is a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, an aunt in Iraq or an uncle in Afghanistan, a kid from the South Bronx or from East St. Louis, you start to understand where they're coming from. Now, I didn't say you agree with everything you hear. How often do we even agree with our family members? But it makes it much less likely that you'll want to destroy them, because you're hearing something familiar. You're meeting someone new. It is breaking the caricatures and the stereotypes that fuel the hate groups. That's why they wanted us off the air. You know, it sounds like your bubba or your baby or your aunt or your uncle. That common ground you begin to find, that understanding is the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war. That's why we have to take the media back. When we flew in this morning from Columbus, Ohio last night, spoke at the Ohio State University in Columbus yesterday. We first went to Ferguson just very quickly. We wanted to go back. We'd been there a number of times since Michael Brown was killed. And I wanted to go back. Dennis and I write a column every week, we have for years, for Hearst, for King Features, bringing out the voices of people on Democracy Now! To the corporate media, a kind of roadmap for people to find independent media. So when we were here several years ago in the midst of the protests around the death of Michael Brown, we wrote this, and I wanted to read a little part of it. The ghost of Dred Scott haunts the streets of Ferguson. Thousands have been protesting the police killing of Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American teenager in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. He was due to start college just days after he was shot dead in broad daylight. Police left his bleeding corpse in the middle of the street for over 4 hours behind police tape as neighbors gathered and looked on in horror. And by the way, I just want to thank Joseph for that wonderful, painful, brutal poem, how important it is to hear this and to not forget. Outraged citizens protested The police brutally cracked down on them. Clad in paramilitary gear and using armored vehicles, they shot tear gas, rubber-coated steel bullets, flashbang grenades, aiming automatic weapons at protesters. Scores of peaceful protesters, as well as journalists, were arrested. The protests raged along Ferguson's West Florissant Avenue, 4 miles south of the protest ground zero. Along that same street, in the quietude of Calvary Cemetery, lies Dred Scott, the man born a slave who famously fought for his freedom in the courts. The Dred Scott decision of 1857 is considered by many to be the worst one in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. It ruled that African Americans, whether slave or free, could not be citizens ever. Dred Scott was born into slavery in Virginia around 1799, the same year noted Virginia slaveholder President George Washington died. Scott's owner moved from Virginia, taking him to Missouri, a slave state. He was sold to John Emerson, a surgeon in the U.S. Army. In 1847, Scott sued Emerson for his freedom in a St. Louis court. Scott and his family prevailed, winning their freedom, only to have the decision overturned by the Missouri Supreme Court. The case then went to the U.S. Supreme Court. In the court's majority opinion, Chief Justice Roger Taney, a supporter of slavery, wrote, "A free Negro of the African race whose ancestors were brought to this country and sold as slaves is not a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution of the United States." Thus, the court ruled all African Americans, whether slave or free, were not citizens and never would be. The ruling also declared the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. The compromise made Missouri a slave state, but dictated that northern territories in the rapidly expanding United States would be free territories with slavery outlawed. The Dred Scott decision opened up all of these new territories to slavery and was deemed a victory for the southern slave states. The decision sent shockwaves through the country. Abraham Lincoln invoked the decision in his famous House Divided speech, saying, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free." The Dred Scott decision would help lead to the election of Lincoln as president and push the country ever closer to civil war. The people of Ferguson have demanded justice for Michael Brown. Dred Scott lost in court, but eventually gained his freedom from another owner. Sadly, Dred Scott died a year later in 1858 of tuberculosis. Miles from his final resting place, the echoes of his life and his struggles persist amidst clouds of tear gas. That piece we wrote several years ago. But it is the movements that came out of Ferguson, the bravery, especially of the young people, who stayed there day after day after day, which finally brought out the national media and shone a spotlight. And you see what happens when the media pays attention to something important, consequential. When they came and showed the militarization of police all over this country, it was absolutely critical to exposing what's happening, the war abroad and the war at home. We write about the killings of black men and women in a chapter in the book called When the Killer Wears a Badge, and particularly talk about the remarkable protests that took place in the wake of Michael Brown's killing. But this goes back decades, our book, looking at the movements that built up to this. We start with a quote of a song by Bruce Springsteen, 41 Shots, American Skin. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret. It ain't no secret. No secret, my friend. You can get killed just for living in your American skin. He was writing, he was singing, about Amadou Diallo. Amadou Diallo, the 22-year-old immigrant from Guinea, returning home after going out for a meal after work in New York in the Bronx. It was just after midnight, February 4th, 1999. We were broadcasting from Washington, D.C. at the time. Amadou was a slight, hardworking man and a devout Muslim, sold socks, gloves, and videos on the street, saving for college, and sent home money to his family in Africa. He shared an apartment with two other men in the Soundview neighborhood of the Bronx. As Amadou stood outside his Bronx home, about to go inside, fiddling with his keys, an unmarked Ford Taurus rolled up. Four men in street clothes got out with guns drawn. The men were members of the New York Police Department's notoriously aggressive street crimes unit, known as SCU, the motto of which was, "We own the night." As Diallo stood in the vestibule of his home, all four officers suddenly opened fire. Amadou died in a hail of 41 bullets, 19 of which hit him. The officer said they thought Diallo was holding a gun. It turned out he was holding his wallet. Amadou was unarmed. He had no criminal record. In the weeks following Amadou's killing, thousands of people marched in protest. A popular chant heard at the rallies went, "Police training 101, it's a wallet, not a gun." Over 800 people were arrested outside New York Police headquarters in a campaign of civil disobedience. The outrage ran deep, and the arrested included a who's who of New York City politicians, religious leaders, and others. Among those who went to jail, Mayor David Dinkins, Congressman Charles Rangel, Gregory Meeks, and NAACP President, former Congressman Kwesi Mfume, actors Ruby Dee, Ossie Davis, and Susan Sarandon, numerous others demanded the four officers be arrested and fired from the force. The New York City Mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, denounced the protests, saying, "This is a great publicity stunt. Can't you figure that out?" he said to reporters. Amadou was buried in his native Guinea. Government ministers greeted his coffin at the airport in Conakry, and Guinea's Minister of Foreign Affairs accompanied the casket 300 miles to Diallo's village for burial. His funeral was attended by 1,500 people. The NYPD Street Crimes Unit had a violent history. Three of the four officers who shot Amadou had been involved in previous shootings, an unusual distinction in a police force in which 90% of officers never shoot their weapons in the line of duty. Three of the four had already done this. Two of the officers, Sean Carroll and Edward McMillan, fired 16 shots each, emptying their weapons into Amadou. Officer Kenneth Boss fired his gun five times. Officer Richard Murphy fired four times. The SCU, which was supposedly focused on taking guns off the streets, had an extraordinary number of its cases thrown out of court. Of the 200 felony gun cases the SCU brought in Manhattan in 97 and 8, half were thrown out. Prosecutors threw out 18,000 arrests made by the NYPD in 1998. The SCU presaged Giuliani's notorious stop and frisk policy, in which police stop and question a pedestrian, then frisk him or her for weapons and other contraband. The policy had a racist bias from the start. From 2002 to 2011, blacks and Latinos comprised 90% of those who were stopped. No gun was retrieved in 99.9% of stops. And overwhelmingly, it was young African-American Latino young men and young women. More than a million stops. For African Americans, it was a basic rite of passage in New York. We have so many kids coming to Democracy Now! Watching the broadcast live 8 to 9 in the morning. And I'll often ask these classes of kids, if they're black and Latino, have you ever been stopped by a police officer? Overwhelmingly, most would raise their hand. I'd ask the same question of a white class. They look at me like I'm crazy. "What do you mean, have I ever been stopped by a police officer?" When they're 13 years old, they say, "What are you talking about?" We live in different worlds, and we need a media that bridges these worlds, that increases communication so we understand what each of us confront and bring those worlds together. 6 weeks after the killing of Amadou, the four officers were charged with second-degree murder, depraved indifference to human life. But in December, a judge ordered the trial moved from the Bronx, which is two-thirds black and Hispanic, 150 miles north to Albany, the capital of New York, which was 89% white. 1 year later, after a four-week trial, all four officers were acquitted of all charges. Sekou Diallo, Amadou's father, called the verdict the second killing of his son. The NYPD Street Crimes Unit was disbanded in 2002 following sustained protests over Diallo's death and the acquittal of the police. The Diallo family sued the officers in the city, saying racial profiling by police was responsible for their son's death. In 2004, 5 years after his killing, the family agreed to a $3 million settlement with the city. 10 years later, in 2014, following a years-long campaign by community and civil rights group, the newly elected mayor of New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio, ended the Stop and Frisk program. In October 2015, this last October, I saw Kadiatou Diallo again. Kadiatou is Amadou's mother. She spoke at a rally of thousands of people right near Washington Square Park in New York City, against police brutality. Some 40 families from across the United States impacted by police violence participated in the event, part of 3 days of protests called Rise Up October. The crowd chanted, "Hands up, don't shoot, hands up, don't shoot," the reference to the killing of Michael Brown, killed in Ferguson in 2014. Kadiatou said to me, she said, addressing the crowd, "My son did not die in vain. He died so that we can have change, but the change has been long coming. We're still waiting. How many more victims were unjustly killed since Amadou Diallo? We cannot even begin to count," she said. Filmmaker Quentin Tarantino also spoke briefly at the rally. He only spoke for a few minutes. He said, "I don't want to take the time. I want every family here to be able to speak." He quickly said, "What am I doing here? I'm here because I'm a human being with a conscience, and when I see murder, I cannot stand by. I have to call the murdered, and I have to call the murderers, the murderers." In response to Tarantino's comments, branding some police murderers, police organizations in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Los Angeles, and elsewhere called for a boycott of all Quentin Tarantino's films. His film had just come out, The Hateful Eight. They said they would refuse to provide security for his projects. The reaction to Tarantino was similar to what happened to rock legend Bruce Springsteen, whose song American Skin, 41 Shots, was about Amadou Diallo's killing. When Bruce Springsteen first performed the song in 2000, he was denounced by Mayor Giuliani and the New York police organizations, which called on officers to boycott his shows. The president of the New York Fraternal Order of Police called this favorite son of New York and New Jersey, this rock legend, Bruce Springsteen, a dirtbag and a floating fag. Springsteen played the song at all 10 of his Madison Square Garden concerts in 2000. And the Diallo family expressed their appreciation at one of the shows they attended. Springsteen also performed the song in Tampa, Florida in 2012, 1 month after the killing of Trayvon Martin, the unarmed African-American teenager shot to death by the white vigilante, George Zimmerman. Following Zimmerman's acquittal on murder charges, Bruce Springsteen dedicated the song to Trayvon Martin. The Diallo killing was part of a long history in the United States dating back to lynching and slavery in which black lives did not matter. The killing sparked a national movement to confront racism, change consciousness and history. Black lives matter. We have a series of pages that got through just a number of months in this country of the cases that have gotten some attention. It is just astounding, this litany of cases. A few of them from 2014 to 15. You know what happened with Eric Garner. Eric Garner, the 43-year-old African-American father and grandfather in Staten Island, July 17, 2014, was choked to death, put in a chokehold by police officer Daniel Pantaleo as he said 11 times, "I can't breathe." The only person arrested in this killing was the young man standing who flipped open his phone and videoed the whole thing. It's the only reason we even know what happened, because there was a video of this. Ramzi Orta was arrested again and again. His wife was arrested. His mother was arrested. And in one of the arrests, the police said to him, "You videoed us, now we're videoing you." John Crawford, 22, Beaver Creek, Ohio, August 5th, 2014. The unarmed African-American man shot and killed by police at a Walmart store when he picked up a BB gun that they were selling, holding it with one hand and talking on the phone with his family with another. Police came into the Walmart and shot him dead. The officers were not charged. And of course, Michael Brown, you know what happened to him in Ferguson, killed by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. A grand jury declined to charge Officer Wilson. Laquan McDonald, who maybe still might take down Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. He was killed October 20th, 2014. The African-American teen who was walking away from police was shot 16 times by white Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in April 2015 in the midst of a close re-election campaign for Chicago for the mayor, Emanuel. The city negotiated a preemptive $5 million payment to McDonald's family. They didn't even sue. Most people did not know about this, right? The election was going on. Rahm Emanuel was in a close election. They did this to prevent this from coming out. In November 2015, when the video was released to the public by court order, Officer Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder. The prosecutor did not indict for over a year. And when the video was released only on a court order, a judge saying and giving a final deadline for when the video had been released, would be released, the video was released and the prosecutor indicted right after that. It shows what it means when we can see the images and how important that is. And then there was Akai Gurley in New York, 28 years old, November 20th, 2014. He's the unarmed African-American man who was killed in a stairwell after being shot by a rookie New York police officer, Peter Liang. The result, Liang was charged with second-degree manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, second-degree assault, and two counts of official misconduct. The police officer had gone into the stairwell of a public housing project, and it was dark. He had drawn his gun, which he wasn't supposed to do, and he opened the door while drawing his gun, and he said that ended up making him accidentally shoot. He killed Akai Gurley, who was with his girlfriend, and the elevator was broken in the public housing project, so he went in the stairwell to walk down, and he was killed. Peter Liang called his union rep before he called an ambulance to save Akai. Tamir Rice, 12 years old, Cleveland, Ohio, November 22nd, 2 days after Akai is killed. Unarmed African-American boy shot and killed by police officer Timothy Lohman within 2 seconds after he and his partner arrived at a playground where Rice was playing with a toy gun. Result in December 2015, an Ohio grand jury declined to indict the officers. And then there was Eric Harris in Oklahoma, Walter Scott. I visited the place where he was killed in North Charleston, South Carolina, who was stopped by a police officer as he was driving into an auto repair shop because his light was out. The police officer stops him. Walter Scott runs, and he shoots him in the back dead, and the only reason we know exactly what happened is because of a bystander who just flipped open his cell phone and started filming. And then there was Freddie Gray. We know about Freddie Gray in Baltimore. His neck, 80%, what was it, died in police custody from an injury to the spinal cord, 80% severed at the neck after his arrest for running away from police. The police said you can't look a police officer directly in the eye and then run. Result, 6 Baltimore police officers were charged with a range of crimes, including murder, assault, and false imprisonment. And the list goes on. Now, we were in Ferguson, covering the protests. And the voices of the people, especially the young people, it's critical that you hear what they had to say themselves. The horror that they faced. As we were there in Ferguson, we were interviewing demonstrators outside the Ferguson police station. As I watched and reported from the middle of the protests, I watched as riot police and National Guard protected the white side of Ferguson, but the black side of town along West Florissant was ablaze. I saw almost no police there. As in August, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon had again declared a state of emergency 1 week before the grand jury decision came down, yet the National Guard troops he deployed were nowhere to be seen in this part of town. About a dozen businesses went up in flames. Why was West Florissant Avenue left unguarded? Did the authorities let Ferguson burn? In his 1968 speech, The Other America, Martin Luther King Jr. addressed fears of a forthcoming summer of riots like those that had consumed Newark, New Jersey, Detroit, and other black inner cities in 1967. Dr. King said, "It's not enough for me to stand before you tonight and condemn riots. It would be morally irresponsible for me to do that without at the same time condemning the contingent, intolerable conditions that exist in our society. These conditions are the things that cause individuals to feel that they have no other alternative than to engage in violent rebellions to get attention. And I must say tonight that a riot is the language of the unheard." That, those were the words of Dr. King. Those unheard, the citizens of Ferguson who took to the streets for over 100 days, were demanding justice. There were solidarity protests all over. As one young man told me, shivering in the cold, his breath visible in the freezing night air as he faced off with riot police, "We're going to shake the heavens." And then I raced off to, in the summer, after first going to Ferguson, I raced off to Staten Island because of the major protests around Eric Garner. And you know that the 1,000 people protest, many of them were not just young people, they were really young people. Girls and boys 10 and 11 years old who made their posters with crayons. And I went up to one girl and I said to her, "Well, what do you hope to accomplish with this protest?" Her name was Anaya and she was 13 years old. She said, "I just want to live till I'm 18. Has that really become the American dream today? To live to 18. These are the voices we have to hear. But don't give up. I mean, the amazing moment that took place in Baltimore after Freddie Gray was killed, after the protests, the voice of Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, the prosecutor, like you have Bob McCullough, right, in Ferguson. This is the prosecutor in Baltimore. I remember looking up at the TV when she spoke. Who is this person? I think she was the youngest state's attorney in the United States. It's the equivalent of the district attorney, the prosecutor. She announced that she had filed charges against 6 police officers involved in Gray's death. She was 35 years old, the youngest state's attorney in a major American city. She said, "I come from 5 generations of law enforcement. My father was an officer, my mother was an officer, several of my aunts and uncles, my recently departed and beloved grandfather was one of the founding members of the first black police organization in Massachusetts." Marilyn Mosby went on, "To those that are angry, hurt, or have their own experience of injustice at the hands of police officers, I urge you to channel the energy peacefully as we prosecute this case. I have heard your calls for no justice, no peace. However, your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of Freddie Gray." She said this after indicting all 6 police officers. She closed with what is certainly unique in the annals of prosecutorial oration. She said, "Last, but certainly not least, to the youth of this city, I will seek justice on your behalf. This is your moment. Let's ensure that we have peaceful and productive rallies that will develop structural and systemic changes for generations to come. She ended by saying, "You're at the forefront of this cause, and as young people, our time is now." We'll see what comes of what's happened in Baltimore. We know what came out of Eric Garner's death in Staten Island. The prosecutor not only led the grand jury not to indict, but he was then elected to Congress. And we know what happened in the case of Michael Brown. But the movements that have grown up around this. In the introduction of Democracy Now!, the book that we wrote for the 20th anniversary, we start off by talking about what's happened here in Missouri, about the movements that have grown up as a result of these killings. And we talk about movements giving us hope. Movements often start with a courageous act of resistance. Those are not isolated acts. They are inspired by past movements. They inspire future ones. Take Jonathan Butler, the African-American graduate student at the University of Missouri, also known as Mizzou. In the fall of 2015, African-American students at the university staged weeks of demonstrations against what they called a lax response to racism. Then Butler decided to put his body and perhaps his life on the line. He launched a hunger strike that he said would end only with the resignation of the university president, Tim Wolfe. Butler laid out the grievances of black students in a letter he issued at the start of his hunger strike. He said, "In the past 90 days alone, we've seen the MSA, that's the Missouri Students Association president, Peyton Head, being called the N-word on campus, graduate students being robbed of their health insurance, Planned Parenthood services being stripped from campus, concerned student 1950 peaceful demonstrators being threatened with pepper spray, and a matter of days ago, a vile and disgusting act of hatred where a university student drew a swastika in the Gateway residential hall with their own feces." Butler was inspired and empowered by the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests in Ferguson following the police killing of Michael Brown. Butler was among a group of Mizzou students who drove 2 hours back and forth to Ferguson to join the protests. He'd never seen African Americans engage in mass protests in this way, he said. He said it was monumental in terms of how it influenced me. He said that the Mizzou protests were part of the post-Ferguson effect. Mizzou students set up a campus encampment in support of Butler's action. They dubbed themselves Concerned Student 1950, a reference to the year that the school's first black student enrolled. The administration also faced opposition from graduate students who fought to win back their health coverage, activists demanding a move to sever ties with Planned Parenthood under Republican pressure. Then some powerful allies joined the fight. On November 7th, last year, a number of African-American University of Missouri football players tweeted a photo of 30 black team members linking arms alongside the statement, "The athletes of color on the University of Missouri football team truly believe injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." They were quoting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The Mizzou football players announced they would no longer take part in any football activities until President Wolf resigned or was removed due to his negligence toward marginalized students' experience. White players, the coach, and the athletic department quickly came out in support of the team. The Mizzou football team is the center of power at the university. College football is a multi-million dollar enterprise. Mizzou, which was cutting health care for graduate students as it invested $72 million in a new football stadium, stood to lose $1 million for every football game it forfeited, and the next game was days away, and the players said they wouldn't play. The football coach is paid $4 million per year, nearly nine times that of the college president. As sports commentator Dave Zirin observed on Democracy Now!, black students comprise 7% of the student body, almost 70% of the football team. These players, thus, Dave said, are at the fulcrum of the political, economic, social, and psychological life of campus, but none of those billion-dollar gears move at all if they choose not to play. the pressure on President Wolf snowballed. The following day, members of a concerned faculty group at the University of Missouri voted to stage a walkout. The Missouri Students Association, representing 27,000 students, undergraduates, called on Wolf to resign. On November 9th, just a few months ago, the president announced he's resigning, along with the chancellor of the campus in Columbia, Missouri, R. Bowen Lofton. Michael Middleton, a black civil rights attorney and former vice chancellor of the university, was named interim president. Concerned Student 1950 continued its activism, calling in a statement for detailed plans to address issues such as minority student enrollment, faculty, staff, and administration recruitment, and health resources for students. Jonathan Butler ended his hunger strike when Wolf resigned. He insisted that what brought about change was not me alone. He said, it was these people that I'm standing here on the stage with. It was the black community. It was the black faculty. It was the other faculty. It was the Forum on Graduate Rights. It was the people of Planned Parenthood. It was everybody who chose to stand up in this time who made this possible. The uprising at the University of Missouri ignited Yale University. Yale students also raised questions about systemic racism on their campus, which led Smith College to protest, Columbia, Princeton, Stanford, and Ithaca College, where I was last Wednesday night. Blacks on campus was trending everywhere. This past January, the Ithaca College president, Tom Roshan, resigned as well.
That's about the time we have for this week. We'll bring you the remainder of Amy Goodman's talk on the next week's forum. Again, you've been listening to Amy Goodman's Kansas City appearance recording on April 9th at the All Souls Forum.